From 90.7 WFAE, this is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Today, we listen back to a conversation with a special NPR personality, Terry Gross. Each day, Terry Gross hosts one of the best hours on American radio. Her program, Fresh Air, is heard on NPR stations throughout the country and is popular, I think, because it touches on all of the topics that touch our lives. Her guests run the gamut from big-name actors and musicians to politicians of all political stripes. And what sets Terry Gross apart from other interviewers is that she has researched her guests. She seems to know more about them than they sometimes know about themselves. And that can lead to some illuminating surprises. When we recorded the show in 2006, Terry was headed to Charlotte to talk to an audience about her show and some of her most memorable guests. When she joined us, she shared some interesting and rare insights into herself. I started by asking what she thinks has made her successful.
Well, I think it's a combination of my brains, talent, wit, and probably good looks as well.
Now, are you being serious or facetious? Come on.
I think that would be facetious.
No. There has to be a combination of those things, don't you think?
You know, it's hard for me to talk about it because it's hard for me to say what it is that people like or don't like about the show. What I will say is that one of the things we try to do that's different from a lot of talk shows, which is very similar to what you do, I think, is a long-form interview. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there are so many talk shows where features are very short right now, and you get a little bit about a lot of things. And it's a nice alternative to hear a lot about one or two things.
Yeah,
really go into some depth.
People seem to be very afraid of depth, it seems to me, in broadcasting today. They seem to be worried that if they light on a particular topic or a conversation with a particular guest that not everybody in the universe likes, that people are going to punch the button and go away. And what I have found in listening to you, and many times, I got to tell you, you're talking to somebody who I've never heard of or I really don't like. And I'll stay with it because
I'm glad we're getting those guests that you
well,
hate.
Well, no. It's not that I don't. I hate them. It's just that they're not on my radar and I don't care. And it's just
no, I understand.
But when I hear you talk to them, I almost always find something about them that is interesting or universal or unique and quirky. And that makes me glad I listened.
Well, that really means a lot to me hearing you say that. And I think part of our criteria for having people on in the first place is that they have something interesting to say. Mm. We do as good a job as we can in screening people before we invite them on to make sure, you know, that we think their work is interesting and valuable, but also that they have something to say about it. Because some people, like, for instance, they might be a great actor, but they might not have anything to say either about their life or their work, about the craft, or even about behind-the-scenes anecdotes. And we're so conscious about not wanting to waste the time of our listeners. Mm-hmm. This isn't to say we don't make wrong decisions and we don't sometimes, you know, guess wrong about what the best guest will be, but we sure do our best to screen people.
But
getting back to what you're saying about this fear of like the long form interview, I think part of the fear in radio, and it's a legitimate one, is that you know, it's not like when you go to a movie and you expect to be seated in a theater for 2 hours. You've just gotten into the car. You're going to pick your kid up at school or the daycare center. It's a 15-minute drive, and then you're out of the car. Mm-hmm. So you only have maybe 15 minutes to listen. So you're taking a risk with the long-form interview that a lot of people won't be able to hear the whole thing. It's a risk we think is worth taking, and I try to always give people re-entry points into the interview. So if they're just tuning in, they'll know where we are and what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there are inherent problems on the radio doing this.
You also talk, if I understand this correctly, you also talk to these people longer than we actually end up hearing them because they're not live with you. You record the conversations and then edit them to fit the segment times of the program. Why did you choose to do it that way?
Well, we usually record about an hour worth of tape, and we edit it to somewhere between 15 and 40 minutes. Before Fresh Air became a national show when I was hosting it locally, I did a lot of hour-long interviews and some shorter ones too, and they were all live. And initially we wanted to keep a sense of the show being live. So I would do a live half-hour interview every day in the first half of the show when it first went national. Mm-hmm. And what I found was when I was doing a live half-hour interview, if the guest gave me a long-winded answer or an evasive answer, instead of being the sensitive interviewer, I'd want to throttle them because all I could think of was like, you're wasting 2 minutes. I'm not going to have time to get to all the stuff I want to get to. And it would drive me crazy. So we finally decided, for several reasons, let's just record all the interviews and edit them. And that way, if there's a dead end, we can edit it out.
Yeah.
And I think that it makes the interviews more rich. And again, getting back to not wanting to waste listeners' time, if we edit out the dead ends and the redundancies, the time that you spend listening to a guest, we hope will be even better spent.
And as I understand it, if they're an entertainer, you give them a chance to answer the question again. If they fumble the answer the first time or don't go where you know it can go or where they think it could go, you'll give them a chance to do it again and only air the good part. Is that true?
Well, what's true is that I will tell people when I interview them, and this isn't true of people in politics, but everybody else, that if they feel like they figured out what it is they really wanted to say after they started saying it, they can just go back to an earlier part of the answer and say it again. And the reason why I do that, you know, if somebody's a print journalist, they could take a confusing answer or a kind of muddled answer and just extract a short quote from it and write around the rest of it to explain it. They could paraphrase what the person said. I can't do that. A person's answer has to stand on its own. And if it's confusing, I can't use it. So I want to give them a second chance to say it as good and clearly and concisely as they could possibly say it. And I've asked myself a lot, is that bad journalism? I'm giving people a second chance. And I think for radio, no, it's fine. You want things as clear as possible. Otherwise, you're not doing the guest or your listeners a favor.
But you don't edit necessarily or give politicians the opportunity to go back and say things again, do you?
No, because politicians are so used to manipulating the press when they can and spinning that often when something is said in an interview with a politician, it's something they maybe didn't plan on saying. And the last thing I want to do is give them a chance to take back something that they didn't plan on saying, only because what they did plan on saying is sometimes so well rehearsed.
And also politicians are very aware of or very shy of or leery of editing. They always, you know, look at journalists on radio and television and point at the edit device as something that's obviously bad and meant to twist their words. And that's, I guess, something you have to be very careful of when you're doing a show like yours, which is not live. And you could be accused of that, I suppose, right?
Well, yes. I mean, we've spoken to several people who our producers, I should say, have spoken to several people who refuse to be on the show unless we do it live with them because they're afraid that we will. They refuse to talk to anybody unless it's live because they're afraid that it will be edited in a manipulative way. Now, I can say with all honesty that I don't think we ever, ever do that.
We're talking to Terry Gross, who hosts Fresh Air, which you hear every day at noon on WFAE. It's been my experience that there's not a lot of training in broadcasting for the people who do what it is that we do. At least no one taught me how to do this. I just kind of learned by doing it, just diving in and making lots of mistakes and getting better, hopefully, and not being so good some days. What was your experience? Was this something that you always wanted to do, or did you just fall into this?
It's something that I kind of fell into. I'd be lying if I said I always wanted to do it. I didn't even know until I was basically out of college that there were such things as interviews on the radio. I grew up with Top 40 radio, Marie the K with the Swingin' Soiree. My parents listened to a station in New York called WNEW, and this was the station that played a combination of great stuff like Frank Sinatra and Ella Fitzgerald and not-so-great stuff like Perry Como and...
Hey, now, wait a minute.
The Four Aces. And are you a Perry Como fan? Or?
Yes, some of it, yes.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's why I don't like Lou Reed, but I don't think you do either anymore. So
no, well, I still like Lou Reed's music. I just don't like that he walked out on me.
Yeah.
We probably won't be going for dinner anytime soon, Lou Reed and I. But no, I continue to love his music. That's one of the things I've learned, you know, doing interviews, that sometimes people whose work you're completely enamored of are not very nice, or at least they're not very nice to you. And then you have to ask yourself, does that mean you don't love their work anymore? And for me, no, it doesn't mean that. I mean, somebody's work and somebody's personality are completely different things. And I think his work is brilliant, and I always will.
We're listening back to our 2006 conversation with Terry Gross, host of NPR's Fresh Air, heard weekdays at noon here on WFAE. We'll hear more in a moment. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and today we're listening back to our 2006 interview with Terry Gross, host of Fresh Air. When we left off, Terry told us she fell into broadcasting after having been fired after 6 weeks on the job as an eighth-grade teacher in English. And I asked her, what happened? Was she not a good teacher, not an authoritarian figure? Here's what she said.
Yes to both. nobody can see me as I speak, but I'm less than 5 feet tall. So I was teaching eighth grade English in Buffalo, New York's toughest inner city junior high. And the students just like towered over me. And I went to college at a time, I was in college from 68 to 72. And it was a time when, you know, everybody I knew in college was challenging authority, challenging the war in Vietnam and things like that. And suddenly, I was the authority figure, and I had no idea how to be an authority figure. And I not only couldn't get through a classroom, I couldn't even get the kids to stay in the classroom. They were mostly in the hall. And I certainly wasn't a very intimidating physical presence. I was only a few years older than the students, and they looked older than I did because I was so short. So it wasn't like a good situation. And also, we were very ill-matched. I was from a very structured, like middle-class family, and I needed anarchy in my life. They were from very poor neighborhoods and often from chaotic homes, and they needed structure in their lives, and they also needed safety in the classroom. And I really didn't know how to provide structure or safety for them. And so I think when I was fired, they did everybody a favor, but most of all me, because I wasn't ready to teach, and it enabled me to stumble into radio.
How traumatic was it, though, being fired from something obviously you had trained for and planned to do?
Well, actually, being fired was the good part.
Oh.
The traumatic part was the work itself, because I knew pretty early on that I was just really not ready for this, and I wasn't sure if I'd ever get good at it. And also, I felt ridiculous teaching the lesson plans I was supposed to teach. I mean, these were students who could, like, not read very well. And my lesson plans were teaching, like, plurals and what's the difference between the singular and the plural version of ox. And I thought, this is something they really will not need to know in the immediate future. And there's probably better ways of getting them interested in language and reading.
But you didn't mind standing up in front of the class necessarily, and you weren't intimidated by being in front of the class, were you? Just the fact that you really couldn't control them.
I was intimidated by being in front of the class. Absolutely, I was intimidated by that. Because I was not used to being in front of a group of anybody, let alone being in front of a group of people to whom you're supposed to impart knowledge. You know, and I just didn't feel old enough or mature enough to be in that situation. I honestly didn't.
You know, a lot of people who teach school who listen to the radio would think it's much easier to stand up in front of a classroom of children than it is to sit behind a microphone and be on 450 radio stations talking to famous people and not so famous people, but being there every single day. And it really is a very different experience, isn't it?
It's very different, and I'll give you one example. My radio listeners don't throw things at me the way my students did. but to answer your question more seriously, I feel so comfortable on the radio. First of all, there might be millions of people listening, but they're not all in a room together. People on the radio listen basically in groups of one,
You know, that's right.
In a group, people listen alone. It's not a group sport. You're alone in your car. You're in the kitchen cooking. You're in your office alone. You're in your studio alone. People used to gather around the radio in the days before television, but I don't really think they do that anymore.
So it really is a much more intimate setting.
It's a very intimate thing. And I'm usually alone in my studio. I'm usually not even in the room with the person I'm talking to.
Why is that? You're like Ted Koppel never had people in the studio when he did Nightline. They were always on that green screen in front of him, even if they were right next door in the next room. Why do you prefer to do it that way? I find this very awkward. I much prefer to talk to people that I can look at and see, where I can read your body language and see if I'm having an impact or whether I'm making you uncomfortable or whether you're going to stop. I find this very difficult to do, and you like doing it this way.
Well, I do, but it's not by choice that I do it this way. The problem we have, you know, our show originates in Philadelphia, and most of our guests are very, very rarely in our city. So if we were actually bringing guests into the studio to be interviewed, we wouldn't have the budget to do it, and frankly, I don't think they'd have the time. To spend hours getting to Philadelphia for a fresh air interview, I just don't think that would happen. So what we can do is send guests to their closest studio and interconnect with them via satellite or fiber optic line. Mm-hmm. And it makes it easy for the guests and easy for us. It very much increases the number of guests that we actually have access to.
Yeah.
If they're in the city, I welcome having them sitting across the table from me, and I enjoy meeting them in person. I enjoy that experience. So it's not like I don't want them in here. It's more like I can't have that opportunity. But there are certain advantages of the long-distance interview, too. There are disadvantages, which are obvious, but the advantages are that, first of all, it's pure radio. Because of the absence of body language, anything that we want to say to each other has to be through our voice, which means that the listener is in on everything that we're communicating to each other. Hmm. And another advantage is I don't have the world's greatest memory. I like to look at my notes. I spend a lot of time writing my notes, and I like to be able to see them. And I like to be able to page through somebody's book when I'm talking to them and look for a quote that has just come to mind or a passage I want to refer to that I didn't know I'd want to refer to. It's hard to do that when somebody's sitting across the table. It's hard to break eye contact. When you break eye contact, your guest thinks it means you're not paying attention.
Yeah.
So it gives me more ability to actually look at tools that I want.
Let me ask you a question that I'm always asked by people, because both you and I tackle lots of different subjects and talk to so many different kinds of people, mm-hmm. with varied interests, and yet you seem to know an incredible amount about these people. It seems as though you've read their book. It seems as though you've listened to their album. You've seen their latest film. In fact, in many cases, you have seen all of their films. At least it sounds that way. How do you do it?
Well, the simple answer is by spending most of my life preparing for interviews. But I think sometimes maybe it sounds like I know more than I do. You know, I do read all of the books. I read the guest book if they've written a new book. But I always put quote marks around the word read, because the reading I do is very different than the reading I do, say, when I'm on vacation and reading a book for pleasure. When I read a book for pleasure, I read it very slowly. And then when I come across a paragraph I really love, I'll call my husband over and read it aloud to him. And I'll just like read certain paragraphs over and over till I'm confident that I kind of get what the author means, or because I like it so much, I'm going to read it over again. When I'm reading for the show, I'm doing something between reading and skimming, and I slow down during the parts that I think are relevant to what I want to talk about and speed up to the parts that I think aren't. And then I'll take notes on the book and refer to those notes when I'm preparing the interview. I'll try to read articles by and about the person I'm interviewing as well. If it's an actor or a director, I'll of course see their new movie. I'll rent their earlier movies and I'll watch a few of them that I haven't seen and re-watch some classic scenes of ones that I have seen, just to kind of get it into my brain.
You know, you just said a few seconds ago, and you laughed, you chuckled your way through it, that you spend most of your life preparing for interviews. people don't have any, people don't do this, have no idea that that's true. I mean, that really is true. You must spend almost all of your waking hours doing this.
Well, during the week, all my waking hours, with the exception of dinner, are basically spent working on the show in one capacity or another. It's not all preparing, because part of it is actually recording the interviews, mm-hmm. hosting the show, writing copy, meeting with our producers, you know, talking about story ideas, returning phone calls, answering email. But outside of dinner, in one way or another, every waking minute, more or less, is spent doing something related to the show.
And you've said that your life is intellectually adventurous, but you're always in a chair reading or watching or listening for the job. Now, here's a person that talks about all of these things and talks to people that affect our lives in various different ways and are part of pop culture in a much broader sense than Britney Spears is part of pop culture. But everything you talk about essentially is about what's happening in the world and America that touch our lives in various ways. But what kind of a life are you having?
Well, it's not quite as tragic as it may.
No, I'm not saying that it's tragic, but I mean, if every waking hour except for dinner is consumed by this radio program that you do every day, and it sounds like it is, what kind of a life are you having? When you look back on it in 30 or 40 years when you decide to hang this up, are you going to be happy that you did this?
Yeah, I think I will be. Because in some ways my life is like unimaginably rich, you know, because what is it that I really love to do in this world? Read books, go to the movies, listen to music, you know, read the newspaper. And these are all things I'm required to do for the show. So it's a nice fit in that mm-hmm. sense. And, you know, one of the things I always – go ahead.
The reason I'm interjecting is because this is exactly what I do. And all of these things are the things that I used to love to do, go to the movies, watch television, read books, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. But now – they have all become associated with work. So when somebody asks me, what do you do for fun? I can't think of a single thing. So what do you do for fun? And what would you do for fun if you didn't have to do this?
Well, what I do for fun does kind of overlap with what I do for work, because what I do for fun is go to the movies. Not necessarily movies I'd be seeing for the show, but sometimes movies I'd be seeing for the show. Or I like going to concerts. And maybe it's related to the show, maybe it's not. I love going to the theater. And when I go to, say, see a Broadway musical, I might as well look for something interesting to do on our show related to it. But that doesn't bother me. If anything, that enhances the pleasure. But to get to the point that you're making, there, you know, I love my work. The only complaint I have about it is that to do a good daily show requires devoting so much time. It requires a real, like, you know, monogamous relationship with your work. I mean, I'm married. I have a wonderful relationship with my husband, but, you know, I don't get a lot of time outside of work.
How does he feel about that?
Well, he understands it because he's a journalist. He's a music critic, mm-hmm. and he could be very obsessive about his work. So when he's writing, he is so lost in what we describe in my house as wordland. So he understands it completely. But, you know, it is a frustration that there isn't more time, like, out of the chair. But like you were saying before, my adventures are kind of intellectual ones. Mm-hmm. I'm a physical coward. Like, if you gave me all the time of the world, what I would not be doing for pleasure is climbing mountains and skiing and canoeing and things that are, like, rugged. I'm so not a kind of physical or adventurous person in that
sense. So it's kind of safe in this little box that we sit in and talking into this little piece of metal. It's a safe place to be, but a fun place to be.
And it's a challenging place to be because you're always challenging yourself, you know, intellectually.
Because you don't do a program like Rush Limbaugh, where a lot of yourself is out there, a lot of your opinions are out there, a lot of your personality is out there, you're pretty much there to draw that out of other people. What kind of a person are you off the radio? Are you gregarious? Are you social? Are you shy? Are you fun to be around?
Oh, am I fun to be around? am I? You know, it's funny. I think I'm both gregarious and shy. And that might sound really contradictory, but I think I'm by nature pretty shy. I always think of myself as having been a pretty shy kid. But if I'm comfortable, I can be, I think, pretty gregarious. And as the host of Fresh Air, I am often in the position of having to be gregarious, and I'm comfortable in that position. You know, I do a lot of meet and greets, and I like to meet listeners, and I meet a lot of listeners, and I'm comfortable doing it, and I find it very valuable to find out what they have to say about the show, what they like, what they don't like. So I feel like I'm both.
We're listening back to our 2006 conversation with Terry Gross, host of Fresh Air. When we come back, we'll talk some more about how she does the show and how she handles difficult guests, including Bill O'Reilly, who walked out on the interview. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're listening back to our 2006 conversation with Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. One of the things I think that makes her such a good interviewer is that she asks interesting questions that most people wouldn't even think to ask. Here we play a clip of her interview with comedian Chris Rock, in which she asks about his voice.
Now, I have a question about your voice. Your voice in your onstage performances in when you're doing comedy is much deeper, louder, and rougher than your voice in conversation, which is higher and lighter.
Right.
Almost sweeter, if I could use that word.
Oh, thanks.
And I almost feel like, gee, are you not comfortable with that voice on stage? Do you feel like you need a harder-edged voice to do your comedy?
Well, you know, it's the money's on the line. It's like people are paying $25. They want a performance. They don't want me. They want me to be better than me. I got to look better than me. I got to be taller, louder, funny. I have to be more. So, I mean, when you're on stage, it's kind of like being a woman, you know? It's like, put on the makeup. Do the hair. You know, nobody wants me. They want Chris Rock. I'm just Chris.
Now, you can do all the research in the world and not come up with a reason to ask that question. Where did that come from?
From just listening to him. You know, because I had been, like, listening to his and watching his HBO special, you know, and I knew his work pretty well, and I'm a fan of his. But talking to him, the voice was so different from what I had been hearing in his stand-up. And I know he's a very smart and very kind of self-aware performer, mm-hmm. So I just really wanted to know what was behind the difference. And I thought his answer was great. I think that's so true. Everything he was saying about how you have to be bigger and larger and different when you're on stage.
And I guess, do you think that you have to be different? Because what we do, these interviews, these conversations that we have with people, although you're trying to elicit information, and I'm presuming that you are genuinely interested in the moment, in what they have to say, it's still an artificial conceit.
It is. I mean, because, for instance, like when I have a talk with a friend, I'm not just asking them questions.
Right. <I'm>, yes.
I'm speaking as much as they are usually. It is a conceit. It is a very artificial kind of conversation, but a very focused and valuable one, I think. I mean, I really love the form of the interview.
Well, I was going to ask you what you think the value of what it is you do. I mean, what is the value of people sitting and spending 40 minutes or an hour listening to a conversation that you're going to have with whomever it's going to be? What do we really get out of it?
Well, I know that sometimes what we get is a combination of the truth and exaggeration and and faulty memory and all of that. But the larger thing that I think we're getting out of it, like when I interview actors or writers, performers, what I'm trying to do is learn what it is that shaped the sensibility that we've come to love them for. I think that most artists are born with some kind of gift, but that gift is shaped by everything that's happened to them in their life, particularly the things that happened to them during their formative years. What kind of upbringing their parents gave them, the neighborhood they grew up in, the school they went to, the things they were exposed to. Were they beaten up? Did they beat kids up? Were they religious? Were they secular? All those things. And so I want to know how this gift they had was shaped by all of these experiences. I also believe that, when I started in radio, it was doing a feminist program. And this was in like 1973 and 1974. And one of the now cliches of the women's movement was the personal is political. what that's always meant to me is there are things that we might think of as just being personal issues in our lives, mm-hmm. or personal problems, personal insecurities. But if we speak of them out loud, we might find out that really these are representative of larger political, social, economic, or gender-related issues. And we won't know that unless we talk about these things with each other. And that's another reason why I like to do personal interviews, because I think we learn about ourselves in a way by listening to other people talk about themselves.
Do you think they learn about themselves as they talk? Because a lot of people don't like to be interviewed, and particularly actors are sometimes reluctant to do it because they want to remain this, I don't know, this formless glob that can be shape-shifted for whatever part they're doing. They don't want you to know them.
Yes, and I completely understand that. And in fact, I interviewed a great acting teacher, Uta Hagen, and I thought, well, she'll want to talk about the craft because she's a great acting teacher and a great actress. And she actually refused to talk to me about the craft because she felt that people who aren't actors shouldn't be thinking about that kind of thing when they see a performance. They shouldn't be thinking about who the actor is or what ways the actor draws upon himself for a role. We should just be seeing the role and losing ourselves in it.
Hmm.
And I completely understand that. But at the same time, I like to know how somebody practices their craft. And to me, I feel that that enhances my enjoyment of the performance.
Actually, I heard part of that Uta Hagen interview, and you were asking her about process. And she suddenly lashed out at you, and she said, well, are you an actress? And you said,
exactly.
No. And she said, well, then you have no business asking me about process. It's none of your business. Which
exactly.
I thought was rather sharp. What brought that on?
Well, just her feeling that it's kind of like a magician doesn't want to give away the acting tricks. And she felt that there's too much of these like Entertainment Tonight kind of shows that go behind the scenes and show you what happened on the set. And, you know, like the DVD outtakes that show you everything that happened that you're not seeing in the movie. She thinks there should be some mystery.
Hmm.
And I completely understand that. But as I said, I enjoy hearing about the process. And I don't think it detracts. I think it enhances my appreciation of people's work.
You said that comics are among the most difficult interviews. Why?
Well, sometimes they are. Not always. Some comics are, some comics aren't. It's really persona comics, I think, that I might have been referring to. The kind of comic who doesn't come out of character. Like when I interviewed Gilbert Gottfried, you know that kind of really loud, annoying voice that
mm-hmm.
he does that's so
right.
funny? Yeah, exactly. That's the only person he would show to me. So I finally said to him, you know, I read that you had surgery recently, and I bet you didn't talk that way in the hospital. I said to him, you know, when the guys who are doing anesthesia come and they talk to you before your surgery and they basically do a little interview, they ask you all these questions. I said, I bet you didn't talk to them in persona. And he said, no, but they showed clips from my latest movie.
Well, you know, is that part of it too, that comics are used to going on shows like The Late Show and Jay Leno and things like that, and they're used to being guided through their routine by the interviewer. It's not really an interview. It's Jay Leno doing the setup and them doing the punchlines. And they come on a show like yours, and you really want to know them, and you really want to talk about some things other than just the comedy, how they got to the comedy, and that's got to be pretty frightening for some of those people.
Well, but some comics are like so smart and mm-hmm. so funny that, I mean, and they just love to talk. But getting back to the persona problem, take somebody like Borat. You know, like Sacha Baron Cohen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think he's a genius. But at the same time, when we were offered an interview with Borat, not with Sacha Baron Cohen, I mean, we've been petitioning to interview Sacha Baron Cohen for several years.
And he won't do it.
And well, he'll do it as Borat now. But I would only talk to him as Borat if he was willing to talk to me as Sacha Baron Cohen after that.
For people who have not seen the Ali G show where he does Borat and two other characters, and he goes out and he interviews everybody. He did Andy Rooney. He's done Sam Donaldson. He's done famous politicians. And he's doing this interview and asking the most outrageous and rude questions from this point of view of complete innocence. And they'll put up with it for a certain point of time. And then some of them leave and some of them just try to play along to be polite. Does it make you feel funny about what you do for a living? Because if he can get away with asking these questions, so can we. So can you.
I never thought of it that way. No, but I wouldn't want to get away with asking those questions. I mean, it's like one of the things he'll do as this character of Borat, a journalist from Kazakhstan. He'll say the most anti-Semitic things. And the point of him saying that is to see how people respond to him.
Mm-hmm. Which do you have more fun with? People that you really admire and like their work, read their books and really enjoyed their writing or their movies or whatever, or people that you don't particularly know very well or don't particularly like, because we can't like everything. Which do you find more challenging, more interesting, more rewarding?
Well, the most rewarding thing is when you're interviewing somebody whose work you genuinely admire, and there's things you really want to know about them, and they turn out to be nice and funny and entertaining and all of that. But there are so many different kinds of interviews. You know, a lot of the interviews I do are like explanatory journalism kind of interviews. You're talking to a journalist who just got back from Iraq and you want to know what the situation is there. You're talking to somebody who's explaining what's happening in the Supreme Court, you know, and those kinds of interviews, you just want somebody who is clear and concise and an excellent and lively explainer. I like, as I'm sure you do too, I like that kind of variety. That's one of the things I really enjoy about Fresh Air, is that one day I'm talking to a journalist about Iraq, and another day I'm talking to the person who created Triumph the Insult Comic Dog.
Anybody ever really intimidate you before you get into the studio? I mean, that you think, oh my gosh, I would rather go to the dentist than do this, because this person is whatever makes you nervous.
Well, I barely talk to the person before the interview begins, so if they're trying to intimidate me, I won't even know that, because they're not in the room with me, and I only speak to them for about a minute before the interview starts.
Right.
To tell you the truth, I like some of those interviews where somebody tries to intimidate me, because it adds a certain drama.
Mm-hmm. I'm not going to ask then about Lou Reed.
Well, Lou Reed was different, because that was, like, he just walked out after about 3 minutes, so there wasn't even... That was just a really joyless experience, because he really did not want to be interviewed and he didn't want to be asked anything. And I think his publicist probably knew how much we wanted to do the interview, so she twisted his arm. And it makes me feel bad when people come who don't really want to be interviewed. Right. So we usually try to make sure they actually want to be there nowadays.
I have about 3 minutes left, and I want to ask some questions that people emailed before we run out of time here. This one's from Andrea, who says, I love listening to Fresh Air and love the way you make your guests think and sometimes squirm with your wonderfully insightful questions. Is there any one question that you could have kicked yourself for not asking a particular guest on your show?
Oh, there's a lot of them, but... Here's one that my producer suggested. After I interviewed Mickey Spillane, who's like the father of a certain kind of like two-fisted, hard-boiled, tough guy detective novel, he had described when he was young, his mother kind of gave him his haircuts and he had this like long kind of girlish kind of haircut. When the interview was over, my producer suggested that I should have asked him about that haircut and if he's kind of compensating for the haircut that his mother made him wear.
And the final question here from Larry, who says, Terry knows her stuff, asks sensitive, useful, intriguing questions. Her one failure was when she did not ask her own questions, but barraged her guest with criticisms made by others expecting him to defend himself. And that, of course, was Bill O'Reilly. Why didn't she handle him the way she does others? Would she interview him differently now? And will she try again?
I think Bill O'Reilly walked out, but, you know, he prides himself on being the toughest interviewer in America. So he should have been able to answer a few challenging questions himself. And anyone who defines themselves as being tough, certainly the interview should be how they handle themselves as a tough interviewer. And I think challenging questions are perfectly appropriate for Bill O'Reilly. I would have done the same thing.
That's Terry Gross, host of Fresh Air, that you hear every day here at noon. We recorded that back in 2006. I hope you enjoyed the show, and I hope you'll consider supporting Charlotte Talks today with a pledge. Thanks. I'm Mike Collins.